The Psychedologist.
Nikos Patadakis is your friendly neighborhood soul doctor and soil doctor. Nikos comes on the podcast to discuss philosophy and psychology, data, insanity, wisdom traditions and psychedelics, metabolizing our experiences, empathy versus compassion, the self, spiritual chocolate cake versus spiritual broccoli, and dangerous wisdom. Nikos is a consulting philosopher who works with individuals and groups in support of the mutual healing of ourselves, our culture, and the world we share. He helps people apply the greatest untapped resource we have, the wisdom traditions of the world, in order to think in genuinely new ways and to fulfill our fuller potentials. He also teaches and consults on ego literacy, teaching, learning, leading, and performance. In this episode, you'll hear us mention a few terms which may be unfamiliar to some. So here is a brief description. One thing we mention is complex PTSD or CPTSD. Many traumatic events like car accidents, natural disasters, are of time-limited duration. But in some cases, people experience chronic trauma that continues or repeats for months or years at a time. This may lead to the development of complex PTSD. In addition to PTSD symptoms, like a persistent sense of threat and hypervigilance, avoiding reminders of the traumas, and re-experiencing or reliving the traumas, people with complex PTSD may also experience interpersonal problems, negative self-concept, fragmented identity, interpersonal sensitivity, affect dysregulation, and self-destructive or reckless risk-taking behaviors. In addition to the above symptoms, survivors of prolonged child abuse have an increased risk of both self-injury and repeated victimization, for example, relationships with abusive people, sexual harassment, and rape. Complex PTSD is not a formal diagnosis in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, although it may be in the next publication of that book. The other term is the Eleusinian Mysteries, and these held an incredibly important role in ancient Greek culture. They involved a secret initiation rite for people, for which people prepared many months, perhaps as long as a year and a half. As a surprisingly well-kept secret, we have limited evidence for what happened in these and similar initiation rites, but it may have involved the use of holotropic or psychedelic medicines and an experience of death that allowed initiates to verify that the soul transcends the body and will continue in some way after biological death. Thanks for listening to The Psychedologist. Here's Nikos.
Hey, Nikos. Welcome.
Thank you, psychedologist. Thank you. Lovely to be. It says that
lovely to be here.
Unstable. I'm sorry, I cut you off, but I was just warning you. It says your connection is unstable, and I hope that's okay. Am I coming through okay?
You're coming through stable. Yeah. You're
good. Okay. Good. Yes, that's good. I should appear stable as a philosopher. It's one of the things I should do is be very stable.
Rule number one.
Yes.
Well, we always start off with what was your relationship to consciousness as a child? Because I was going to say, how did you become a philosopher? But maybe we'll get there through this question. So I'm all ears.
Yes, that's good. You're one big ear. That's a very Zen thing. There's a wonderful koan where they're talking about a case of spiritual common law. So just like we have common law where there's no legislative statute that has been passed, but because a judge has so embodied and expressed something that we feel is, yes, that's justice, then that ruling becomes like a common law. We just take it as that's what. And so in spiritual traditions, there are teachings, of course, but then there are these encounters between sages or between a sage and a student. where the sages and maybe also the students' responses are so emblematic of wisdom, love, and beauty, so iconic and expressive of it that we take it to be a, like part of our common law, spiritual law. And so this these two philosophers are discussing this image of a bodhisattva who has 10,000 arms, and you know, like that's crazy, you know, so a big archetypal image. And you know, the one says, how in the world does that bodhisattva use those 10,000 arms? That's crazy. And the other one says, well, you know, it's like in the middle of the night, you adjust your pillow, but you're really still asleep. Ah. And so he's thinking about that. And so he says, well, I think I understand. Well, how would you express it? Well, the whole body is hands and eyes. And the other fellow says, well, that's pretty close, but it's like 8/10 of it. Really? What's the rest? He says, throughout the body, hands and eyes. Throughout the body, hands and eyes. It's like we're filled with that wisdom and compassion, wisdom and love, just coursing everywhere throughout. So your ear, as your all ears, it's the ear of compassionate and wise listening, is just coursing through all of you. I like that idea that you have.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Cool. And I want to say it makes me think of the octopus, because I was just learning how they can see in every direction, and like their brain is spread out through their whole body. So I guess they're all brain, like they're all sensation and change.
Oh, yeah. Right. Because sentience is throughout us, too. I mean, we have, it even transcends the skin. We trap it with it. But the octopus is so wonderful. I wrote a poem about the octopus and those eight arms being so awake, like ours, more than, we have that capacity, but that's what that spiritual common law was saying. No, we are awake throughout the body everywhere, but imagine what it's like to touch the world and embrace, to live like a big hug moving around. It's wonderful. Yeah, I'm sure you saw the documentary.
I saw My Octopus Teacher, and I loved that so much. But last night I was watching this show on Netflix called Animal, and it was the episode about octopus.
Ah, okay, that's marvelous.
I recommend them both.
Yeah, there's a move to recognize the sentience of crustaceans and maybe octopi. You heard about that?
In the UK, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really good. Yeah. What did you think about when the octopus teacher human person?
Well, spoiler alert, student, spoiler alert. Okay, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I you know, that's funny. You caught me in something that I often think that if I know something, probably everybody does, because I know so very little. And I'm like, well, I know how it goes. So, I mean, like, I don't know anything. Everybody must know. You're right. I do that sometimes with you know, psychological data or philosophical references, and I think, oh, but I've only read 12 books. I figure you probably have read that too. Okay, yeah, I shouldn't bring that up. There is a controversial moment, let us say.
Oh, you can say it. We gave the spoiler alert. Now anybody who didn't want to listen is like waiting till we finish.
Yeah, skip forward. But what did you think about his non-interference?
Painful for him.
Yeah.
And would I probably would have interfered, and that says something about me. You know, I think I over-interfere maybe at times. But I think that it was very moving to me, like watching that. It was deep. What did you think?
Yeah, I wondered about it in just the sense that it seems to abide a little too much by a certain way that dominant culture science has gotten us to relate. And that if that were my friend, and it were a human friend, you would say, why didn't you help your friend? But it was my friend. It was apparently my teacher. Why wouldn't I help my teacher? I think we have, I mean, that's the thing about spiritual common law too, is that the ethical imperatives of any tradition ultimately come to us as things we have to contemplate, and that sometimes there are times when apparently we must challenge, or you could even say, you know, break what appears to be an ethical imperative. And sometimes our imperatives will conflict. That's part of it. And we have to know what to value, you know, so that if a person really values non-harming, but there, it really seems to be this absolute crazy situation you're in where a person who's out of their mind is about to harm your child. And the only resolution is to physically intervene and grab that person and potentially harm them. Well, you might say, well, I had to do it. I really to protect my child. And so that's, you know, the ethics aren't like, here's the rules and they're unbreakable. That's it. And it's clear in every case and they never conflict. And well, that's a simple-minded notion. So I understand he was abiding by something that he felt was an imperative, but there is also the question of, well, look, you have broken the boundary. You know, this is a friend. And, you know, so how do we keep the intimacy without just interfering that we can decide, you know, what goes on in the natural world that we're a part of?
Yeah. It makes me think of something that stuck with me from philosophy class, which was something can be, there can be an explanation for why something happened. There can be an excuse and there can be a justification, right? Like if I hit a person on the road, I was driving and I hit a person, the explanation could be, well, I was putting on mascara, I was texting, I wasn't looking, I was like speeding and I hit a person. That's the explanation. The excuse could be, well, a bee flew into the car and stung me and I was trying to get control back of the vehicle and I swerved off the road because I was having this reaction to this bee sting. That would be an excuse, some might say. And then the justification would be, well, there was like 10 baby carriages were in the road and I swerved to avoid hitting the 10 babies. And so I hit this person and that maybe would be justified.
Right. Yeah. I think it's interesting that you bring up being in a philosophy class and being a little bit helped by some discernment. I mean, it's a difference we could say between discrimination and discernment is valuable. And sometimes though we get into this analytical discriminating mind, but it's also, we were talking a little bit before we started recording about how different philosophy is. And I always find Thoreau's line from Walden a good touchstone. He said, there are nowadays professors of philosophy, but not philosophers. Mm-hmm. And I really do respect what a lot of my colleagues do in the university. And I would always, you know, think to myself how bright they were. And how, for all I knew, the most important new development in human thinking could come from somebody in the philosophy department as well as any other department. But there is something about that that seems true. And a French scholar named Pierre Hadot, he looked at the history of the dominant cultures, philosophical traditions, and he felt that this was true too. He affirmed it and was very well regarded for giving a scholarly argument for why contemporary scholarship is not really philosophy the way it used to be done, so that we really aren't even reading the old philosophers the way they intended to be read and interacted with. And that in part has to do with the lack of practices. So you could say that I might suggest to my colleagues they aren't rigorous enough, even though rigor is such a big thing in the academy, being rigorous in your scholarship, but the rigor might also come from certain things you have, certain ways you really do have to live. So that can be part of the disconnect. People think, oh, you're a philosopher, and immediately there's a pejorative sense because most people's exposure to it is in the university, where really they don't necessarily get something that's alive and feels like a guidance for the soul and a medicine, because that's what it was. It was therapeia, therapy for the soul. And that's why there's such a kinship, I think, between philosophers of that orientation and psychologists, because that's where psychology is coming from. And as I think I wrote to you, Jung thought he was a philosopher. He thought that what that activity, analysis, was a philosophical activity. And he used the term antique philosophy. He meant, well, it was what Plato and Socrates were doing. And this is just the form it's taken. And that he specifically said, you know, in the stuff that goes on in the universities, that's just cut off. You know, we are philosophers, though, we psychologists. And that's why I think most of the major therapeutic orientations have roots in philosophy. It's often quite evident. Other times it's sort of almost like anxiety of influence. Like we don't want to, I remember when I took a lot of psych courses because I thought I almost double majored, and then I thought I was going to go into graduate school and be a therapist. And so I studied a lot of psych, and I have had psychology professors who, if one of the first things they wanted to do is differentiate it from philosophy. We're this real thing, and let me get, and they're often the you know, really data-driven ones. And it's cool, but it's like, hey, that's a little bit of a big denial there because, you know, anyway.
Well, I'd like to respond to that. And then I'd love to hear what your relationship to consciousness was as a child, because we've got to get there. We've got to get there. But first I'll say, absolutely, one of my favorite professors in grad school, the first day he said, psychology does not answer why. That is for philosophers. We answer what and how and who and where and when, but we don't answer why. And I teach psychology, and I still tell my students this to this day. So now I want to hear if you tell me now or tell me later, like, do you think I should continue telling them that? Should I add some nuance to that or not? Because people always, in psychology, everyone does come in like, what are you most interested in? I want to know why people behave the way they do. But so there's that I want to say. And then I also want to bring in from your website, I loved this quote, vain is the word of the philosopher that heals no suffering. I just thought that would bring more, even more color and flavor to this discussion.
That's a big part of the lineage, my lineage. That's Epicurus, who was seen as a sage. And I really would say that it's because we've got bad philosophy in the culture that you think that. It's not your thought. It wasn't your professor's thought. It's the culture's thought. We face a philosophical crisis. You know, the climate catastrophe happens because of a philosophical orientation. So no psychologist can escape being a philosopher, in the sense that you have to make decisions about what, just defining the field is a philosophical thing. I mean, there's nothing that comes out of the data that says what psychology is. You know, you could study all day and you say, yes, this proves what psychology is. No, you define what it is. And that's why Skinner's philosophy is different than Freud's. And we have a philosophical disagreement, which of course, then we try to go out and find data, but that's no different than philosophy has ever been. Because if it was therapeia for the soul and the philosopher tells you something, you go test. Well, the philosopher said this was going to make me feel more peaceful. And so then you go and check it out. And so, yes, you are absolutely engaged, because philosophy means how we do things. And so one's philosophy of psychology is how I do the research, how I define the questions, and so on and so on and so on. Moreover, and I think secondarily, even in its position, might be more primarily important in a certain way, is that we have some evidence that dominant culture science needs a paradigm shift. And I think the paradigm shift is to recover what the scientists dumped on their way. And so I think this is a weird little thumbnail sketch of what went sideways in Western or dominant culture's development, is that Socrates was actually wise. According to the tradition, he was viewed as a sage. Epicurus was viewed as a sage. You had these people who were seen as sages, and they basically said, this is not easy. It takes years. It takes years to become wise. And part of the theory of knowing in those traditions was that knowledge is partly a function, what you could say, importantly, a function of how we know. We often treat in the dominant culture like, well, the world is just out there, and I'm going to go find out, and then I tell you this is what I know. But we have begun, even our own science says no, but it depends on how you've questioned nature. That gives her constraints for what she'll say back to you. And we see that so clearly in quantum mechanics and systems theory, cybernetics. It's so obvious. We see it. And so this old teaching, though, essentially meant that our knowledge is a function then of our development, that we believe certain people because of the kind of person they are. We understand that they're the kind of person who has access to that insight about the world. And that if we train and practice, we can have that access. So if you want to know how to do a certain thing in ballet, and you have to practice and learn the move, and then you know it. And so What that meant was that Socrates was saying, here's this high bar for becoming a knower, a valid knower, where people could say, yes, this person really knows because look how much they worked on themselves. And that's what wisdom is, which is a very comprehensive sense of knowing. And instead, along the way, we said, well, look, it's so much easier to kill a bird than it is to know how to listen to them and to be with them and to be in relationship and understand and hear the world speak through them. And I can just cut them open and then I know all the organs and I can tell you all these things. Why should I have to become wise when I can get this thing that I'll call knowledge? And I think that's part of the problem. We started to seek knowledge. We left wisdom, but science in a culture that could thrive should really go back to thinking of itself as philosophy, as it was. It was natural philosophy for a while, but then it was like, no, we don't want any of this love of wisdom, philosophia. Why should I don't want to love wisdom. I just want knowledge. And that's also why I think we have to hold science accountable for its integral role in the climate catastrophe and in injustice of all kinds and so on and so on. All the mess that we see, science goes absolutely hand in hand with it, as much as the scientists might want to think themselves, no, it's not me. No, you can't. I don't think that's so easy. What's a compassionate science? What would a compassionate relationship be to data? And how do we receive data? Data means given. How do we receive it as the gift the world gives to us? What do you do with that sacred gift the world wants to give to you? And what will you listen to? What will you ask for? What will you receive? These questions are really deep and important, but I do encourage you. That's a long, boy, that was the whole soapbox. That's it.
I love it. I appreciate what you're sharing. It reminds me of another thing from school. And then we just got to go over to you on your relationship to consciousness. I am committed to hearing about it. But I remember in something that made me feel insecure in, I think it was like sixth grade, was we had to answer this question. Where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Where is the knowledge we have lost in information? And my brain was like, I know those three things are different, but I think I understand it now. And what you said really like hits onto it. And I was listening to a podcast, Monica Gagliano. She studies plant behavior. Looks like you know her. I was listening to her on Adventures Through the Mind with James Gesso. I like that's probably my favorite psychedelic podcast. And just how she was cutting fish open to study them. And but the fish became her friends. This is really circling back to the octopus teacher. And then one day when she was going to go grab another one to kill it, they all like wouldn't come hang out with her and they were all hiding. Like they knew that she was, and it took her so long to process the grief of that. She stopped doing animal dissection and then started learning from observing plants. And then they became her kin as well. I love the story and that is wisdom. I agree.
Yeah. Wow. That's really great. Yeah. I like that. That's it. And Lao Tzu has a lot about this sort of thing. And in particular, even he talks about it at a cultural level. If you read Tao Te Ching, he says, you know, by the time you've got laws, you are so cut off from justice. You're in a really bad way. And that's interesting that some indigenous cultures might have had sort of certain kind of code, but they like the indigenous critique people on Turtle Island, the original inhabitants of Turtle Island, their critique of the dominant culture included the fact that we had all these laws that were coercive and punitive. They didn't have those, and yet they had much. The missionaries acknowledged that they were much more peaceful. The society was very democratic. That was a really, these were disturbing things. So there was this indigenous critique. And, you know, actually, the what's this new book that Graeber and so is it The History of Everything?
Mm-hmm.
They have some of that material in there. They've done a good job collecting it. I looked at some of that whenever I was doing some research at the university, and it's just so important to realize that our sense of ourselves comes from indigenous people's critique and then our response to try to say, no, but we're the society of progress and all this because we're trying to justify hierarchies and money and all these weird things. And certainly, yes, that being cut off from wisdom and cut off from justice, just, you know, and the laws make up for that. And science, as we talk about it, makes up for being cut off. It's a trade. Why should we trade? you know, it will mean that some people will decide that some of the work they're doing, yeah, that they shouldn't do. And that's not easy. When, I mean, we know there are scientists out. I remember a fellow philosopher of mine went and he said, oh, I was so excited to get out of the philosophy department and go to the hardcore scientists. And he said, my goodness, was I in for, and this is a well-known person. I won't name it so that no associations get, this is a well-known person who collaborates with scientists to develop sophisticated experiments, very well-regarded thinker in the field. And he said, man, I ran into a scientist and, you know, well, this is great stuff. Why? I haven't seen you in any conferences. Oh, well, that's because I used to have a relationship with so-and-so and they won't invite me to any of the conferences that they do. And then he goes to the next scientist and finds out, well, you don't really seem, this isn't really working. But the line of research is so well funded that we're not going to. So these weird things, we're pursuing lines that we know are not, either they're not super vitalizing or they're, but you know, we've got all these, you know, demands that come in there. And to say, well, what if I step back and said, you know, what's the wise way to pursue this? And what's the compassionate way? And how am I going to help heal the world and guide the culture? That's very different. Science just needs such a revolution in its thought, and many scientists do too. And that includes just being honest that we're philosophers. So if you want to know the history, to go back to the consciousness part, I think I'm a good example of how it's not very present for most of us, because, you know, the word philosophy was never said when I was a child. And then by the time I found out that other people in the family, my grandfather was a coal miner, a first generation American on one side, and the other side was there a little bit longer, just a couple generations, and they were immigrants who worked in the mines. And so they had to, you know, I mean, this is not an easy life. But I found out he had 5 daughters. Everyone did know the word philosophy, or apparently did. When I came home from the first semester in college and said, I'm going to change majors and I'm not going to become a lawyer and go into politics and, I'm going to become a philosopher. Then everyone freaked out, you know, and you could say maybe in a certain way that was part of the discovery, a deeper discovery of consciousness, in like a way that it started to become real. But we were talking about how too, there's a lot that's left out, you know, Thoreau and I think my ancient lineage, I think Socrates would be surprised by a lot of what happens in a philosophy department, but I could say, well, I was really interested in it. And then it became clear that philosophers were kind of confused, in a certain way, you know, that it wasn't geared toward, yes, when you come to a philosophy, we are here to help support your growth as a human being, your healing of self and world in mutuality, the expansion or opening of consciousness in some way. I mean, these are difficult things to talk about because people don't like certain ways of talking about it, but something like that is not part of, we're not, the philosophy in the academy is not psychedelic. It is not about manifesting the mind and studying it. I could say that safely. Anyway, so I do remember when I was a kid, I had a prophetic dream and predicted lottery numbers. And when they came out, that was the end of that, because everyone was so excited that I had predicted that day's lottery that, of course, they wanted me to do it. Maybe I was on my way to be very conscious. And then my dream was shut down.
Oh, wow. So I'm guessing they wanted you to give the next winning lottery numbers, but you couldn't just like intuit on command, right?
Yeah, it couldn't. Yeah, it's funny.
But what happened after that with your gift?
Well, it does come back from time to time. I think that one of the things about there's a wonderful dialogue where Socrates, Plato records these things, you know, so we get it from Plato. We're getting some of Plato and some of what his teacher had to say. And in this dialogue, Socrates says that there are 4 kinds of madness that give us the best things that we have. And I, that's why I use the word madness always in a positive sense. And obviously too, that we've gotten sensitive about, oh, geez, that we shouldn't say that. I do think it's reasonable to say that the culture is a pattern of insanity, and it has us. And I mean that in a very specific way, that like, perfect examples of the pattern of insanity. The simple ones are that, obviously we burn carbon. Burn fossil fuels, goes in the atmosphere, raises the temperature, then we have to turn the AC up higher. And so that's a pattern of insanity. Then you went to, you're going on and on. Even bread is like that, where when they finally figured out how to industrialize bread, they were so excited because you could make more money, you know, because before you had to buy your flour, like, you know, after a few days, it was rancid because of the wheat germ in it. The oils would turn rancid. And so, well, geez, you know, what's a good capitalist to do? Well, when they did the industrial process, it squeezed every last bit of wheat germ out. And now, shelf stable, we can ship it all over the place. We can make a fortune. Then people started to get nutritional deficiencies. They started to get rickets, and they said, what's going on? Well, it turns out the bread's not healthy. It doesn't have, not that it was a great idea to begin with, but at least it did have bare nutriment in it, you know? And so that, now you could say to yourself, oh, well, it turns out we can't make industrialized bread. But what they did was they said, oh, now we can make money selling synthetic vitamins. The chemical industry can have you. So that's why when you buy the Wonder Bread, it's got, and you know, a lot of other things too, have all these vitamins. Why do they have to put it? Because they killed it. It killed bread. So we eat Frankenbread, and that's, there's been a change, of course. Now people are realizing, wow, I don't have gluten intolerance if I eat a good sourdough that's been made, you know, in a nice way with whole wheat. Okay. So the pattern of insanity of the culture, it does grip us and have us do behave like insane ways. But Plato was saying, well, there's madness is the only cure. Say, wow. What, wow. How is madness the cure? And the four kinds of madness that I think he wanted us to understand, philosophy makes possible and is integrated with, I guess, in a way. So the first one is initiation. He had gone through the Eleusinian mysteries, and we all know that, and our psychedelic audience knows about that. So Plato was a mystic, yes, and so was Socrates, and they would have been through the mysteries. And what they were in part trying to, I think, do is correct some of the spiritual materialism. What we sometimes narrow down by saying spiritual bypassing, I think the word, it's more, it's a more general set of problems, but spiritual bypassing and spiritual materialism that the mysteries can get infected with. Because, you know, come on, Plato and Socrates are looking at their culture saying, this thing is, it's not healthy, but everyone goes through this big experience. So it's clearly not working. And he had the same problem with arts. We've got geniuses, they're writing these plays, but then it's not healing the culture. We're still headed toward catastrophe. So initiation, and he wanted people to understand philosophy is an initiation into mysteries. So it's a good path. He wanted it to be a truly healing path for the culture and for yourself. The next one is a prophecy. Uh-huh. And it's expected that as philosophers develop, they will have prophecy and that we have the capacities in there. And then a love, wonderful one. He thought it was a kind of madness. And then poetry and the arts. That's again the idea that the artist visits the place the mystic lives. And when they visit, they get that inspiration, they get the madness, and then they come back. And Plato's problem was they don't know how to navigate that space very well. When they come back, they don't know which parts really are wise and which aren't, and why. And then the people interacting with the work, they don't know really how to let it heal them. So there's not a good ecology of mind there for it. And so philosophy was supposed to integrate those. So you could say, as I've gotten a little bit better at practicing philosophy, which I feel like I just started about a week ago. So that's good. You know, I always say that, you know, thank goodness I just started practicing, because, you know, every time you go a certain distance in your practice, relatively speaking, you say, wow, that's what practicing means. What have I been doing for all these years? So yeah, I do find it there, and it has appeared at other times. I did confess to do. I do Yi Jing readings for people. I used to do tarot readings and was surprised, like, get out, like, weird. Why am I saying this? It doesn't make any sense. Because it's true, says the other person. Well, but these are quite real, and we have good data. You know, that's another thing to keep in mind. There's good data, and that anomalous data, again, is the challenge to dominant culture science. It doesn't fit for the psychologists, many of them anyway. But then, did you read Elizabeth Lloyd Mayer's book, Extraordinary Knowing?
Not yet.
Oh,
no.
Everybody read it. I have a podcast episode about it too. So you can get a couple Clips Note things about it. It's so good. I think I called the episode "This Changes Everything," because that was her experience. She had this experience, and I don't want to give it away. It's so cool. And she's this, you know, scientific person. And then she discovered that all kinds of other psychologists and psychiatrists, she was a member, I think it was I think it might have been the American Psychoanalytic Association. But anyway, she put out a thing to have a special group on anomalous phenomena, and they were flooded. All these therapists were coming out of the woodwork when nobody had ever talked about it. And she realized, wow, it's happening. And Freud believed that psychic phenomena would be part of the therapeutic experience. He acknowledged, of course, Jung, we all know that he was super, for him, those things were often key to the transformation. Anyway.
Oh, okay. I'm thinking so many things. Well, I want to also talk to you about like the wisdom traditions and psychedelics and how these could be more friends. Excuse me. And I'd also like to bring in like something I mentioned before we started recording was that I didn't like philosophy at times in college. And I had this feeling that it had some like toxic masculinity or something. So I love the love part there. And yeah, so I'm just thinking about psychedelics, wisdom traditions, and love as well. Mm-hmm. Over to you. Yeah.
That's so good. And that's what I love about my lineage. In some ways, I think to myself, well, it's good I'm a Greek person, because it that means I carry the wound of Logos as it became imposed in the dominant culture. That was not, I think, you know, it just really went sideways. And Socrates was aware of some of the problems. He was really good at not knowing what he didn't know. He was so good about that. Whatever else we think about Socratic irony, he really was willing to listen to somebody. And he went to people in his culture who could say to him, oh, Socrates, I know what I'm talking about. And they could point to their success as the evidence, you know? So he would go to Elon Musk, because Elon Musk would say, oh, I know a lot. Look how smart I am. I've got billions of dollars. I couldn't have made all that money if I didn't know what I was doing, Socrates. And then Socrates would question them, and it would turn out they didn't know. But he always had that frame. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. And then there's a dialogue where he says he knows something and everyone is amazed. And what's the topic? Love. It's the one thing he says he knows something about. And tellingly, he learned it from a woman, Diotima. He was initiated into the mysteries of love. And he then presents to us this thing that we call, I mean, you know, it's just spirituality. It's just whatever, learning what am I and what is this world and how do I live well here? What is this? And he's saying, well, the answer to that is the path of love. So philosophia is that we get that word because Plato was trying to say love is the path. And it's also, there's a double entendre there, because there is that one loves Sophia, this goddess, this, you know, non-dual feminine. One loves wisdom, but at the same time, wisdom is its own kind of love, and love is its own kind of wisdom, you know? So when we care about something, it doesn't matter what it is. Like if you just only care about burritos, you still you know where the best ones are. You know what makes them the best. You know what the sauce is that you have to put on. So if you love anything, you want to know how to relate with it well. And that's the wisdom part. So if you love a sentient being, maybe it's your life partner, and you see that they're unhappy. And so you go, you make them a sandwich and they say, you know, this is peanut butter. Yeah, yeah, it's good. No, but I'm allergic. Are you trying to kill me? So it would immediately take that to be some lack of understanding and love. Love has to do with some level of understanding. And that's also, I think, one of the most important relationships between the wisdom traditions and psychedelics, in particular, that we find out love and compassion are practices. They are inherent to us, but it's like you come out of the womb, you can speak languages or communicate in a linguistic way that we think of that. But if you never get exposed and you never get the training, you won't speak. You won't have that. And if it has to be sign language or it has to be whatever it is, you need that interaction and that training that brings it out of you, the capacity. And compassion and love are like that. We have the capacity. And when we encounter someone who evokes it in us, it's not that we need, it's not that they made the love, it's that they showed us our heart's capacity. And compassion, I think, is also really important there because of that particular training has been well verified, not only by its elaboration over 2,600 years, in particular in the Buddhist philosophical tradition, that Siddhartha developed compassion training really to help people. It was a medicine. It shows that's such a good example of a philosopher following Epicurus's dictum. He knew that people, some people just can't meditate, and that some things can be really challenging if you go into retreat and so on, and you start to meditate for a long time. And we found this out in the dominant culture, is that people think they can just meditate. No, that's like, I think I can just drop acid. No, you need to have preparation. And so the ethical preparation and training in compassion, it really makes a huge difference. So if you went to Buddha or Plato or and you say, I want, teach me, help me have some insights. The first thing they're going to ask you are things about your life. Are you being a good person? Are you living an ethical life? And it's interesting, a study just came out, it was a really excellent demonstration of this, that showed, we can maybe put the link in there, Matco. And actually, I was going to also try to remember to bring up Adela France's recent study on spirituality as a mediator in working. And so what is spirituality? And it's, in other words, it's like saying some philosophical path is a mediator for the good things that we want from psychedelics. But what Matco showed, she was looking at yoga and mantra meditation and ethical training. And she and her team. And what they showed was that the greatest benefits that were coming, and they were looking at stress and well-being, the benefits were coming, bigger benefits with ethical training. So it was either ethical training by itself, or it was ethical training in combination with one of the others, that the ethical training is more important than the meditation or the yoga if you wanted to get the well-being benefits from the yoga. And, yoga's core training, so very similar to, say, Thich Nhat Hanh's 5 mindfulness trainings. And he wrote a book called For a Future to Be Possible, where he says, look, we have to have, there's an ethical common ground. The Dalai Lama has been really such an important world philosopher in saying, hey, every tradition has a space for love and compassion. And there's no venerable philosophical, religious, I don't care what your tradition, there's this place where we can all be together and say, we understand love and compassion are important. And he said, the good thing is my tradition has some practices, and I don't want you to convert. You can be a Christian, you can be a materialist atheist, but you could still learn. And we've even shown by the lights of the science of this culture that this really makes a huge difference. And I think that's one of the most important ways that the wisdom traditions can help, because we've learned how to work with compassion and that it is a skill. And that it really, I've been amazed at how important it can be in working with the medicines in terms of preparation, being in the space, and then integration.
Now I'm thinking about the reverse direction of how, like, psychedelics could help someone access compassion. Do you think that makes sense too?
It does. I think the thing is, it's the same way we were talking about how the medicines can show you something that you have. So if you consider MDMA and PTSD, one way to understand it. So here's, let's say, a loose general thing. We practice not metabolizing our experience for the most part. We're maybe 50% checked out. And just in general, and there was some research on that. Maybe you saw that people can look it up. There's a little article, or you can email me if you don't have access. I know if you're not in a university, you can't always get stuff, but it's called A Wandering Mind is an Unhappy Mind. And they just were using a simple phone app and found out that mostly people were checked out because they would randomly send you a text and say, what are you doing? How are you engaged with it? Are you thinking about something else? And what were you thinking about? Was it positive or negative? And then, you know, how happy are you? And so, and no matter what, it turns out that people can be distracted even during sex. Now, obviously, you weren't answering the text, but afterwards, you know, you get the text, say, oh, well, geez, we were just having sex. And then it turns out that it's very unlikely your mind will wander, but it did happen, even in that study. And they found that on average, about half the time, people just weren't, they were checked out. And whatever it is they were doing, even if they found it sort of unpleasant, if you were doing the laundry, and you were doing the laundry, you were happier than if you were doing the laundry and thinking about the next vacation you were going to take to the Bahamas. Like, oh, I hate doing laundry. I'll think about that trip. No, you're not as happy. So what's interesting is if we take that as a general idea, and then we say, if a big wave of experience comes in, and we've practiced not metabolizing it, we're probably still not going to metabolize it. But if it's positive, though, we call it ecstasy and bliss. And we say, oh, it was wonderful, and it was oneness and all this. But still kind of we haven't fully metabolized it. And that's part of what Rick Strassman's critique is, right? I love that. He's really being a good philosopher. And he's saying, yeah, people can have a spiritual experience, but it's not really a philosophical experience. It's not helping to heal the world in the ways that we need. We need to cultivate philosophical training, a whole holistic matrix. If it's negative, we call it trauma. But it has that commonality that we've practiced not metabolizing it. Now, the problem with the trauma is, in order to metabolize it, you'd have to have a basic space of some kind of space of positivity. Otherwise, you can't look at it. Now, here's one of the key things about empathy versus compassion. When they do the brain scans in order to verify, are these two things different? What differs from empathy and compassion, for empathy is our basic capacity to resonate. When you yawn, I yawn. They used to play laugh tracks. I haven't watched the sitcom in a long time, but they used to play laugh tracks because you find it funnier if there's the sound of people laughing. You're just more inclined to think it's funny. And when you feel pain, I feel pain. When you feel positive, I feel. So empathy is just that basic capacity for resonance. But in terms of our life and the way it works, empathy is like flapping your wings and compassion is flying. You can flap your wings a lot and not get anywhere. And in addition to that, flying demands more. You got to know how to ride the wind. You got to know how to let go. And so how do we learn to fly? Now, when they make this differentiation, one of the things that they also find is that empathy, if you are staying stuck in that space, you will begin to experience empathic distress when you're in the presence of suffering, whether it's your own or somebody else's. And that empathic distress is a self-protective mechanism that wants you to leave. So if it's your own suffering, you want to get out of there. If it's somebody else's, again, too. If it's the world's suffering, you don't want to look. We double down and we start, we buy another SUV. We trust the scientists are going to fix it because we can't look. We're afraid we can't handle it. Compassion teaches us we can handle it. Now, this is the key thing. When they look at the brain scans, they find that there is a space of joy in the brain that's lighting up in the practice of compassion versus empathy. Mm. So if you are experiencing empathy and it's a difficult situation, there is no joy there. Compassion in the face of something challenging, the space of joy is still there. The person is not getting off on it. They actually are more clearly aware of the suffering. Their perceptual channels are more open, but they don't leave the basic space of joy that the mind has that makes it possible for you to feel, this is workable, I can do something. The other thing that goes with that is that parts of the brain that would be lighting up if you were getting ready to move, to physically do something, they light up in compassion. Even if you're just laying still, obviously in a brain scanner, the mind is ready. I can work with this. I can face this. And it's in part because of that basic space of joy. Now, if you haven't had that history of practice to touch that and keep it, then when something challenging comes, it's not there. If you take MDMA, it just lights that up for you. And so that's my kind of philosophical suggestion about what's really working. Well, it shows you, no, you could be still in a state of basic positivity. Not that you like it, but just, no, I feel basically a feeling of love and positivity. And so therefore I know I can stay here and face this. Now I can metabolize it. as the practice of compassion spreads, we'll find that we have that capacity that the medicine is revealing. Some people, they can't wait, but everybody could integrate it. They could begin to see that all the medicine did was remind me I have that. So yeah, I think it's really important. Yeah.
Thank you for that. And so in a practical sense, how would I know, other than the joy indicator, if I was being empathetic versus compassionate? And if I felt like, yeah, being empathetic was tiring me out, draining, but maybe I would be less drained if I was compassionate, how could I shift into that?
Yeah. And that's one of the ways it was discovered. Tanya Zinger, who's a very, very well-regarded researcher at the Max Planck Institute, the one in Leipzig, she was studying empathy and was really getting clear on her theory about it and everything. And she put Matthieu Ricard into the brain scanner. Matthieu Ricard is a kind of a Mozart of the mind. You know, he was trained as a PhD in biochemistry or organic chemistry, worked at the Louis Pasteur Institute, and a very bright guy, and then became a Buddhist monk. Walked away from all that, but he's still very, you know, conversant in science. But he became such an experienced meditator that he and Mingyur Rinpoche, Yongi Mingyur, they were declared the happiest people on the planet because of their brain scans were so incredible, what they were experiencing. And Tanya Zinger was doing this empathy study, and she put Matthieu Ricard in the scanner. And it was supposed to be a 2-hour experiment in 30-minute blocks. And after the first 30 minutes, she shut the scanner down and pulled him out. She said, "What are you doing in there?" He said, "Well, I'm practicing compassion." She said, "Well, stop it. It's not right at all. This is not, do you know what empathy is?" "Yeah, sure, I can do that." So she put him back in there. And so he was in there for 90 minutes, and she brought him out again. And she said, "Well, that was good. That was empathy. I'm curious about this compassion stuff you're talking about. Do you feel, you've been in there 2 hours. Can you go back in?" He said, "Oh, please. I need to go back because I feel awful." Yeah. Because they were showing these difficult images. And he said, "I know what people must experience. That's horrible to, you know, to be a care worker, a nurse, or, you know, to be working on yourself and to see these difficult things." And so he said, "Please, I really need to go back and practice." And he did. The important thing there, I think the lesson is, I always say, I love, it's like a common thing for me, is this Joni Mitchell line where I love that she says, "You don't know what you got till it's gone." And then I think the thing we have to remember is, if you never had it, you don't know it's missing. You won't know the difference or what to do until you practice. And a lot of people experience empathy. And I don't know did you ever read Borderland? What's that? Bernstein.
No.
Good Jungian analyst. Oh, it's really nice, because he's saying that this also marks, this kind of hypersensitivity marks some transition for the human being. It's really fascinating work where it's, you know, he had a client who really taught this to him, because she, just one day, she was driving behind this stock car with cows in it, and she experienced all this incredible fear and anxiety. And he was trying to, as a good depth psychologist, suggest, well, you know, could that be projection? And she was saying, "It's the cows." And he finally just let it be that she was feeling their experience. And compassion says, "Well, don't shut that down." You know, see, this is a problem I have with a lot of mindfulness talk among psychotherapists too, but it's not just them, but we all want to say, "Oh, you know, these mechanisms for heightened awareness and so on, that was when we were all out in the savanna and there could be a lion. And, you know, you hear a sound in the bushes and, oh, it could be a lion, but then you find out it isn't, or it is, and you run away and then you're better. But now, you know, it's your email and your bank account, and that gets you freaked out. And we all have to realize that we're safe. That's important. And at the same time, why tell the soul that it doesn't know its business? Why not say, well, what if the soul is saying, well, I'll tell you why I'm anxious. There's no lions anywhere. I mean, they're in cages at the zoo, but these were my friends. The trees are dying. I'm breathing toxic air. You don't know that something's off." And so the compassion allows us to heal, to take care of that suffering, and not simply to say, "I want you to go away." Because then we might have the ability to say, "Oh, you know, I'm upset because there's just a lot of trouble here that we need to address this. And that mobilization comes in. I feel like I could do something. So it's good when we have soul scurvy to recognize that we may need these kind of nutriments. So I hope that answers your question. You know what, how do we know? We got to practice. We got to see what it's like and find the capacity. And then we say, okay, yeah, now I start to know. And there's lots of practices that we can do.
Oh, thank you for that. Yeah, I think that you answered it. And I want to ask you about one more thing before we wrap up, which the time has just flown by, and I'm not surprised by that. What's something I heard in a class I took last night with Ariel Schwartz? She was talking about EMDR and somatic psychology, somatic therapy in treating complex PTSD. And a person in the class asked, well, what about traditions of non-duality? And what about like transcending self and, you know, the oneness of all beings and for people with CPTSD? And the teacher said, well, if there never was a self to begin with, because the person was neglected or abused, or like they didn't form, a sense of self or like compassion, I guess, for themselves. And then they try to, and she said that indeed, many people with complex PTSD are drawn to spiritual traditions with non-duality because it feels really comfortable. So just wondering if you had any thoughts about that.
Oh, yeah, that's a really important one because, see, this is the thing. In part, we are kept, education in the dominant culture, I would say, especially the U.S. as the leading edge of the pattern of insanity, education in the dominant culture exists to protect people from philosophy and art. And because if you got exposed, you have to have dysfunctional education to have a dysfunctional culture. Otherwise, people wouldn't put up with it. And so this is what Socrates is saying. Only by means of bad philosophy will the Athenian Empire collapse. I mean, sure, there could be some accident, but, you know, that's the surest route to a mess. And so we've been kept away from philosophy. Therefore, we don't even know what to do. So we're drawn to, you know, this non-dual thing or that. It's really important to find a lineage that will also give us a vision of ourselves and to find good teachers because, you know, Buddha, who had this idea, well, okay, things are not self in the ordinary sense. Well, but when one time somebody came up and said, you know, is there a self? And you know, he didn't want to say no. And the fellow walked away and I think maybe Ananda was with him and somebody says, well, what's going on? And they said, well, if I told that person that there was no self, they'd be a nihilist about it. You can't just go around telling people these things. And so we may not be ready. We have to do a lot of healing. This is why Jung was so skeptical of the Eastern traditions. He said, look, I see what the Western psyche, my friends, and a lot of that stuff is not going to work. Maybe one day. But people need real healing here. We have really gotten off the rails. And so I think the suggestion is this is partly why we need holistic philosophy. Don't try to invent it yourself. We treat spirituality like it's a supermarket, you know, or it's a buffet. And everybody wants the spiritual chocolate cake. Nobody wants the spiritual broccoli. And we don't know what to do. And we have to be willing to engage in critical thinking and not just imagine, well, I'll just do whatever I want, the self-styled thing. And yeah, I like the non-dual. You really may need a teacher who will say, and a lineage who will say, let's get you grounded in right living, ethics, good livelihood. Let's start with healing meditations before we go running into non-dualism, because people can have bad experiences. Just like you can have a bad experience with the psychedelic, meditation can. There's no reason for it other than we fragment everything. I'm just going to go be a non-dual. What does that mean? Because Buddha could cross the street, you know, if somebody called Jesus, he turned his head. I mean, it might have been one with the divine, but, you know, they could navigate space. So whatever non-dual is, it's a little more sophisticated than just, you know, these people didn't walk around saying, I don't exist. So even our understanding of it is so, we just want to say, I know, and we need to not know. We need to spend some time not knowing and finding out what the traditions might offer that's real guidance and has been worked out over a long period of time.
Yeah, well, that resonates. humbleness and curiosity. What do you do to get connected to your consciousness or to, I don't know, what have you been enjoying lately? What kind of treats for your mind, your body have you been doing?
Wisdom donuts. The treats. Well, I have been, I'm lucky that it's, being a philosopher is one of those jobs where things get very integrated, because when I work with people one-on-one or even teach it, it could be a group, that very much draws, it activates the practice. But always, I think some good meditation practice, Qigong, I think something, I like Qigong because of the getting in touch with energy and moving energy. I think even if someone does yoga, it's worth adding a little bit of Qigong. You don't always touch the movement of energy in the same way. And a lot of the asanas that we have now are much more modern, whereas Qigong's movements usually have a little bit more, they've been experimented with a little bit longer. So those things I think are super important. And being in nature, horses are always a big medicine for me. It's a big sort of central part of the medicine family. So horse time is always, oh, that's really good. Love working with horses. They can save America, my friends. They made this place. They made Turtle Island. Horses and beavers. That should be what's on the money. Horses and beavers made Turtle Island. The bison, buffalo too. Yeah. Anyway.
So, well, I mean, let's not forget the bees.
Oh my goodness. That's absolutely, no, that's so huge. They're teachers for me. I've always been so sacred to me. And I was stung on the belly when I was a little kid, and then that just changed my relationship with them. I really love them so much. Yeah. Yeah. They're so important. Venerate them. Don't eat almonds, friends, because that's just when they pollinate those trees, they're sending the bees off. They know they're going to lose. Like it could be half the population. Anyway, find another vegan milk.
That's some more insanity right there.
Yeah, that's more of the pattern of insanity. Of course, organic's a little bit better, but there's still a lot of water use. There's this really, of all things, there's this little local, I hope this doesn't cause some viral problem for them, but there's a place called the Philosopher's Stone Ground. I like that, the Philosopher's Stone. And it's just here in Santa Cruz, and they do dry farming, no irrigation, no spray, and they make almond butter, and it is really, boy, you can tell the difference. It's just really, really clean. That one I'll do, because that one seems to be, there's no bee casualties over that one. But thank you for reminding me of the bees. Boy, they're special bees. So many special bees, aren't there? Yeah. We need these friends. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Nikos. Where can people find you? I'll put the links in the show notes. But yeah. Oh, wait. Before we go, I wanted to ask one. Can I ask one last question?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. What's dangerous about it?
Oh, that's wonderful. The question is so important. There's two things. One is the self-help catastrophe. The self-help catastrophe is where we have our healing just by default. This is something everybody working in any way, and certainly with psychedelics, this is so set. It was so important for people to recognize, like ayahuasca tourism is a good example of this. But our healing, because the culture is a culture that makes us into takers, then our healing must come at the expense of the world. That's just how we might want to tell ourselves, well, no, I really want to help the world. But the process that we use to get well is usually a taking process. And we really have not given back to the systems of life. And so the self-help catastrophe relies on fragments of wisdom. So this is, there's dangerous in two senses. The bad danger is a fragment of wisdom. We recognize the little glimmer. But because it's fragmented, it means that we're pulled into that self-help catastrophe. So it's dangerous to have fragments of wisdom. Socrates called this correct opinions. He believed that people had partially correct opinions, but that wasn't wisdom. But that's what allowed them to succeed. They could take that partially correct opinion and essentially leverage it against reality. And he said, there's always going to be negative side effects from that. So the planet pays for our ignorance, unfortunately, and she's done. So she's given us a clear signal. Look, I've absorbed as much human ignorance as I can do. Now, it's dangerous on the other hand, too, because the most important danger of wisdom is two structures of power inside and out. So that's why so governments got concerned about psychedelics. Why? Because, well, you don't want people glimpsing some kind of insight that could make them realize that, you know, what we're doing. So the ego also, it's dangerous to the ego. So when the ego is excited about philosophy or psychedelics, it's often like a person says, well, I'm so ready. It means there's already something in there that thinks it's going to control the outcome. So sure, you can have your bliss, but then when you get back, I'm going to go back to doing the things I want to do. I'm not worried about this. So the ego is going to try to control it because it senses the danger. And the only philosopher I know of who put what I would call like the spiritual surgeon general's warning on their philosophy was Buddha. That's one of the reasons I love him so much. Socrates was clearly aware of this, but Buddha comes out and says, handle my teaching the way you would handle a poisonous snake. Now that's a good philosophical warning. Handle all of this the way you would handle a poisonous snake, because if you just grab at it, next thing you know, you'll be bitten. And you might not even know you've been bitten. But the culture and the world will, so the community of life that depends on you to become wise, loving, and beautiful, it will suffer from your kind of, you know, spiritual materialism. So yeah, that's what's dangerous. It's the good danger and the bad danger. We need to know about those dangers. That the ego will try to control it, the culture will try to control it, and that if we can handle that well, then we become the medicine. Then we really can heal self and world in mutuality.
Well, I think that's a perfect place to stop. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dangerouswisdom.org, right? Any other places?
That's it. Yeah, you can get everything from there.
Thank you, Nikos. You are wonderful.
Yes, you are too, my friend. It's been a delight. Thank you so much.
The Psychedologist is Consciousness Positive Radio. Find us everywhere podcasts are hosted. For more information, visit us on Facebook or online at thepsychedologist.com.